So a couple things. I guess most of these are gone. Maybe all of them are gone. But you can get these. This Inquiring Mind, a Buddhist journal, the Vipassana tradition, the Insight tradition, and they invited me to be the guest editor on this issue, which, as you can see, is on addiction. Actually, it kind of looks like that's the title of the magazine. I have a piece in here, Noah Levine's piece. There's some stuff on mindful eating. There's some stuff on sex addiction, on cyber addiction. There's an interview with Martine Batchelor on letting go, teaching she's has in her new book. So I'm pretty happy with it as a sort of an overview of the Buddhist recovery world. So the other thing I wanted to mention is that there's an organization now called the Buddhist Recovery Network, which I'm part of, board member. And it's actually started by a guy in Australia who he had a website called BuddhistRecovery.com. And he contacted me and some other people and suggested we put together some kind of an organization. We had our first conference in Los Angeles last October. A lot of the people who were in this magazine were at that conference and speaking there. So we have various functions, one of which is that our website, which is now BuddhistRecovery.org, and there's now, oh, that reminds me. Thank you for talking about that. You're welcome. Okay. Someone last night or yesterday at this addiction conference gave me some little flyers because there is now BuddhistRecovery.org.uk. So here is, if you're interested, we'll put these out. Can we put them on the table? So, to me, a lot of the function of this organization is to just have a place where people can be informed, particularly about groups that are forming. Just obviously, the 12-step recovery movement is founded on community and on groups and meetings, and so one of the things that's sort of naturally grown out of people's interest in Buddhism and recovery is having groups where people get together and meditate and maybe read some literature, share, however they want to operate. And so our website now has listed all the groups or meetings that we know of in the world. So it's divided by country, and then like in the U.S. we have it divided by state. There is actually a small group in Newbury, led by Vince Cullen, who has an article in here about a monastery in Thailand that where people go to detox. So if anybody's from out that way, it's called the Fifth Precept Group. Yes?
Can I just say that Ed has created a sign-up sheet here for anybody interested in this day in setting up a group in London.
Yeah.
So if anybody would like to leave their details at the end, you're welcome to do that. We'll probably put an email around to London Insight. Email it just following his name, Mr. Blythe.
Good.
And also say that that Inquiring Mind, we do receive London Insight receives Inquiring Mind. The box arrived yesterday. What the theme was, otherwise I would have brought it to you. But they will be available from next Sunday, so we have a day long next Sunday, and they'll be available then to future dates until they go. So, anybody who can get a copy there.
Yeah, and their website too, you can go to their website. The magazine's free, they operate on a Donna basis as well. You can go to their website and ask them to send you a copy. There's also some extra articles on their website that didn't fit in the issue. And so, yeah, it'd be great if a group started in London. It'd be terrific. I wrote a piece of group guidelines that is on the Buddhist Recovery website. It's also on, I believe it's on my own website. But it sort of addresses some of the major questions about forming a group, and you know, one of which is leadership. You know, in AA and the other A's, you know, there is no leadership per se. You know, it's kind of rotating. Anybody can sort of take the role of secretary. But Buddhism is more of a hierarchical religion, and there's a reason for that, because it's easy to kind of go astray with Buddhist teachings and with Buddhist practices if you don't have some guidance. A lot of people will say, I'm sure you've heard people say, oh, that's very Buddhist, or that's very Zen or something, you know? And very often, they're talking about it on a very superficial level. So when you get a bunch of people together who have that kind of superficial understanding, and they start sharing, you can wind up with a bunch of very confused people. And so I think it's wise to have somebody who's experienced enough in practice and in study to at least kind of bring people back to the basics and up to some of the critical understandings. But of course that's, you know, every group is can do what they want, but that's one of my suggestions. The other one that I say in these group guidelines is this shouldn't be considered a replacement for a 12-step or any recovery program, because Buddhism is not a treatment for addiction, even though the principles are quite harmonious with that. I have seen people try to use Buddhism as a way of avoiding recovery work, because it's like they don't like those meetings or those people or whatever, and not be successful. When you meditate in silence, there's nobody in there but you. And you can lead yourself astray. And so I think it's best to have some guidance and some support, a program. But, we each have to make those decisions for ourselves. What else did I want to share? Now that I'm on this mode, which I've covered a lot, I will say that there are more books these days. It's becoming a regular booming market, mindfulness and recovery. The one that I particularly like, that I was asked to endorse, I think it's coming out next month. It's called Mindfulness and the 12 Steps by a woman named Therese Jacobs Stewart. And quite comprehensive. She's a therapist, and she's a recovering alcoholic and a trauma survivor. And she kind of goes very skillfully from her own story into Buddhism, but also into the kind of therapeutic counseling kind of mode, and opens up a lot of things. She's got a lot of information. It's been published by Hazelden, and a lot of those books can wind up under the radar. They're not going to be bestsellers. So, the 12-Step Buddhist is also something that came out a couple of years ago. My wife immediately objected and said, "You're the 12-Step Buddhist. Who does this guy think he is?" But Darren Littlejohn, also a good resource. Anyway, that's enough of that. So this is what I want to ask you now. How full are you? How does your stomach feel right now? Did you eat to 9 or 10, or did you hold back? Stop at 6 or 7? Really, the mindful eating practices, they're quite simple. A lot of them are mentioned in this article in Inquiring Mind. Mainly they are, of course, being aware as you're eating and taking pleasure in your food, so you're really tasting your food, something you also neglect to do often enough. Surprisingly enough, since eating is one of the most pleasant sensual experiences we can have, but often we just kind of rush through it. So there's experiencing flavor and texture and all of that. And there's awareness of hunger level, awareness of fullness level, and there's something called taste satiety, which is noticing how the flavor is, how you're losing flavor as you eat. And we tend to do something called chasing the flavor. Mm-hmm. So as the food, taste buds kind of get numbed after as you're eating. You keep stuffing stuff in your mouth, trying to get more flavor going. I also am very interested in craving and noticing how, despite the cues that are coming from my body, there's still a craving in me. Often it feels like it's coming from my mouth. And often it's a craving for something sweet, really, is where where just that final thing. And finding ways to negotiate that without overindulging, but without also being frustrated. There's a way in which you can kind of be suspended. It's like, when's dessert coming? Something's missing, that little sweet. I started working with this, with these ideas, which essentially what it meant was I just started eating less, just naturally, last year when I started working on this project. And I also accepted something that my wife had been pointing out to me, my abuse of butter, which isn't traditionally thought of as a substance abuse problem, but when I stopped eating butter, I lost 50 points in my cholesterol in 6 months. So anyway, I'm not lecturing you on eating. I don't mean to be. But I bring it up because food is a huge issue for the world and for addicts. And many people, you get over the alcohol, and then there's the sex, and then there's the food, and then there's the money. And so it's just another one of those things, that's either addictive or it's just troubling. And it's interesting to bring this into your practice, into your program, not in a punitive way. I'm not really a fan of the abstinence-based eating programs. For one thing, in about 2 weeks you just fall over dead because you haven't been eating. But the abstinence programs that say, I can't eat this or I can't eat that, and the mindful eating people, the researchers, I don't really like that world, but their argument is that when you set up this all or nothing, that you wind up going all, because you do the nothing for a while, and then they call it the abstinence violation effect. Love these terms. That, I'm not going to eat any sugar. I'm not going to eat no dessert, no ice cream, nothing. No. And then one day it's like, I'll just have one bite. Oh, well, now that I've broken it, I just might as well eat the whole gallon, jug, right? Which does happen with drugs and alcohol as well. But their point is that there isn't the same, that it's actually possible to say, I'll eat in moderation. I'll have a small amount. Rather than taking out the whole box of cookies, I'll take out 4, 3, 2, whatever cookies, and I'll eat them. And I'll have the best way. Now, there are some people I know in OA and other eating programs who say they simply can't do that. And I have to respect that. That for them, certain foods are just like alcohol is for the addict. And I'm fortunate that that's not my... So I'm not trying to convert you, if that's you. But that's not my condition. So I'm someone who's not, I guess, a food addict. But I just have the food, tendency to overeat. Well, anyway, in any case, I lost 15 pounds and I kept it off. So, and I've dieted before and lost weight and, of course, put it all back on right away. So I found that my relationship to food has changed. I don't know if you... I feel like I'm like, why are you talking about this? That's... Just shut up. I'm talking about it. So leave me alone. Because none of you were saying that. It's just... in. It's a very troubling thought. So, have we finished our kapha and ready to meditate a bit more? So, when we meditate after a meal, it's often an opportunity to work with the hindrance of sleepiness. And particularly to be alert for that. To realize, oh, this is a situation in which this might arise. And as soon as you get the first tipping of the head, or dulling, spacing out in the mind, that you strengthen the posture. Open the eyes, just letting your gaze rest in front of you. You take some deep breaths. And then you work with that energy. Let's begin by closing our eyes. And now you can be more specifically clearly aware of your belly. How the food is doing down there. Feeling yourself sitting. Coming to the breath. People who coined the phrase now for something completely different. I'd like to work with a mindful dialogue exercise. It's all very well and good to meditate and be mindful of your breath and mindful of your thoughts, but we spend most of our life in relationships. Certainly in 12-step programs, it's speech that's the main practice, listening and speaking to each other. In fact, there's one famous passage from the Buddhist teachings where he says, noble friends and noble conversation are the whole of the holy life. Of course, when I read that, I figured he must be exaggerating. Which he was. The Buddha did exaggerate at times to make the point of how important it is to connect with people. So I'd like to do an exercise in which you'll have a partner, one-on-one, dyad, as we say. And one person will be listening and one person will be speaking, and I'll give you a topic to explore. And each person will just have a few minutes, 3 or 4 minutes, to speak. And I'll ring a bell and we'll change roles. Other person will speak, other person will listen. So, there are two aspects of this practice. There's the listening and there's the speaking. So I want to talk about mindful listening and mindful speaking. Mindful listening, quite simple. Instead of listening to yourself, you're listening to the person who's speaking. You're doing it right now. Talking to yourself. Speaking. Judging. Wishing. God, shouldn't they have softer chairs? Whatever your complaint is, that's mine. But questions. So with mindful listening, we start to notice when we're thinking. And yeah, listening, mindful listening. You notice when you're thinking and just let go of it and come right back to this, to the person, to what they're saying and to them, their presence. Every time your mind wants to interrupt or take you off, make some comment, make some judgment, maybe rehearse for what you're going to say, you just let that go and come back. So it's not so much mindfulness and the noticing everything else that's happening. Much more of a concentration. We just keep coming back to this one focus. Really emptying yourself out so that something else can come in. And to do this, it can be helpful to have some attention in your body. So you might feel some neutral part of your body, like your limbs, or some people like to connect with the emotional part of the body, which tends to be the chest and belly. Or you might just feel the breath. Maybe yourself sitting in the chair. Just to have some attention in the body helps to ground you and helps to take up the spectrum of awareness. So that if you're listening, you're not, there isn't as much room for thoughts to come in. It's a very useful practice. For anybody who's in a listening profession or just goes to meetings, to just drop your story as you're listening to someone. You know, it's very common that we have kind of auto response when we hear someone share or someone from the, you know, maybe you're sponsoring someone and they start to tell you about their problem. And, you know, the classic kind of AA thing is you've got kind of the checklist. Well, you need to go to more meetings, you need to call your sponsor, you need to write an inventory, you need to get a higher power, blah, 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 right? And sometimes we're not listening to what's actually going on. We're just giving these rote responses. And of course, those are all wise things to do, but they aren't always the thing that the person who's speaking to you in this moment needs to hear. So before we give advice or guidance, I think it's very important to listen fully without your prejudice, without your checkiness. Just allow it to come in and allow that you don't have to always have a checklist. If you let it come in and let it go deeply into you, you will find very often that a deep response comes out. That intuitive wisdom that we each have, that sometimes we don't trust enough, if we wait and listen for that, then we may be of more service, of more help in our guidance. Now, in this exercise, you're not going to be responding, so that won't necessarily be called upon, but I really encourage you to work with this exercise in your own life, particularly, as I say, in those kind of situations that call for care and attention. Well, that's mindful listening, which in some ways is simple. We can say that's a pretty simple process. Mindful speech, more difficult, I think, more subtle, because, well, my theory, it's not exactly a theory, but the way I look at it, is that our ego, our sense of self, is made up of words, largely. Thoughts take the form of words. So when we speak, it's very natural for it to come out as an expression of our ego. So we are projecting how we want to be seen. We are projecting our memories, our pet ideas. You know, it's all, there's this show that we put on, right, for others. In order, we want to evoke a certain response from people. But oftentimes, the truth gets lost in that. Both the literal truth and the emotional truth. Sometimes the emotional truth gets lost simply because we don't want to share that. And certainly, it's not something we want to share in every situation. But to learn a practice that helps you to be more present in that way when you speak and after all, right speech is part of the Eightfold Path, and it's also one of the five precepts. So it's obviously a very important practice. So let me talk a little bit about how I work with this. First of all, again, to embody the experience, to embody speech, so that you feel yourself here in this moment. You're not lost in your mind. Lost in your story. You're here. You feel yourself sitting here. You know, often you see spiritual people with mala beads. You know, and I think with speaking with some beads in your hand is a good way to ground yourself. Just to have something that you're touching. And you see speakers with a pen in their hand or something. You know, I think it helps to ground you. You can just feel yourself in your chair. Just feeling your body. Then, trying to... So, if the instruction for mindful speech or right speech is to say what is true, helpful, and timely, to say what is true is quite tricky. There's not that much that we know absolutely to be true. So, oftentimes, you'll find that you say things like, I always get angry, or I'm never like that. And there are these broad statements that kind of solidify reality that aren't really provable. So if you're trying to say what is true, you need to sometimes modify or make provisional statements like this. It seems like I'm always depressed, or I'm often angry, or I sense that it would be helpful if I did this, rather than I should be better at that. So just noticing how language itself has a way of creating reality. It creates that reality because if we believe these absolutes, we start to act on them, whether they are true or not. If we believe we're always depressed, it's kind of depressing, you know. If we believe, I tell a story in this new book about, you know, I learned to play the guitar when I was 12, but I believed I could play chords, but I didn't believe I could play lead guitar. So I didn't try to learn. It wasn't for 10 years until I started to really learn to play lead guitar. And then I discovered, oh, I can play lead guitar. All it takes is taking the action, right? The karmic action. But if you don't believe you can do something, then you won't attempt to do it. And therefore, your belief, your thought, creates the reality. It's not, you know, this idea of the secret about how your thoughts create reality. It's not that, you know, I think about money and it starts falling from the heavens. You know. But it's rather that your beliefs influence your actions, and your actions then create the reality. So being very careful with the words you say, because they not only have an impact on this moment, but they have this broader impact. So taking time, and this is an exercise in which you don't have to be worried about being interrupted, because there's an agreement that one person is just going to listen. So you can stop and take time to consider what it is you're going to say. And one of the pieces of this is to have a sense, another way of expressing what we're talking about, is to have a sense of speaking from the heart rather than the head. And you can even feel that. Sometimes people will put their hand on their heart as they do this exercise. And you can even feel that when you put your hand here, that it immediately brings you into a different place of expression. Right? Interesting, you know, body-mind connection, right? Touching yourself. Oh, yeah. There's a gentleness that naturally comes. This kind of integrity that comes, pulls you out. So to have that sense of coming from this deeper place, listening to what you are about to say before you say it, and considering whether this is exactly how you want to say what you wanted to say. Now, that sounds like a pretty lengthy process, but it's not, because the mind is so quick that we know what we're about to say, and there's a moment, just as you breathe, to speak, that you know what you're about to say, and you can consider it, or take a moment. You find it. So, finally, one of the pieces of this is to avoid telling your story. That is to say, repeating memories and ideas about yourself that you've accepted as one solid thing. It doesn't mean that you can't talk about things from the past, but when you talk about things from the past, you talk about them from the reference point of this moment and what you know and what you're experiencing in this moment. And then there's an authenticity to it. It isn't, oh, you know, my mother did this to me and because of that, I'm like this. You know, no chance for change in there, right?
That's just the way it is.
I'm just saying, you know, oh, there was this experience, and, you know, it's come down kind of like this, and I've kind of lived like this based on that, and that's how I felt. You know, it seems like I'm kind of stuck in this path. You know, that type of, you know, just sort of looking at it, mulling it, but being real and truthful. So this is a lot of explanation, and I presume that once you start to speak, you'll forget it all, which is fine. And really, it's just to kind of get across the idea, just the sense of it. So before we take the next step, which will be getting a partner, I'd like to just see if there are any questions about the instructions I've given.